Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Well, it's Wednesday the 5th of April 2023, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop from the Construction Index, here to talk about all things construction. Or a few things construction at least. Phil, you there?
Hello, morning David.
Good morning, how are things with you?
I'm very well. I'm very excited actually this morning, David, because it's Asbestos Awareness Week.
Oh, I wasn't aware of asbestos awareness.
Well, an important subject.
It is.
But it's also today, April the 5th, it's National Raisin and Spice Bar Day.
That sounds nicer, I have to say.
Tomorrow is Tartan Day. But in terms of the month, April is a very busy month, actually. The things we have to be aware of in April, I'm told, according to the awareness website, it's Stress Awareness Month. Testicular Cancer Awareness, very important. Okay. International Caesarean, very important. Bowel Cancer Awareness, Parkinson's Awareness, IBS Awareness,
Blimey.
National Autism Awareness, all very important things. Mathematics and Statistics Awareness Month. Didn't know we needed an awareness month.
No.
Jazz Appreciation Month and National Pet Month. But the one that I found particularly interesting was the day after tomorrow, which is Good Friday, and certainly in this country it's a national holiday for most people. I'm sure some people will be working on Good Friday, but I won't be. It's National Walk to Work Day.
Oh.
Which seems slightly bizarre to have National Walk to Work Day when no one's going to work. Well, hardly anyone.
Yes, somebody obviously didn't look at the calendar before they decided that.
Yeah.
Okay, oh well.
So we're not going to talk about any of those today, are we?
Not going to talk about any of those.
What I'd like to talk about first, I know we've got a guest coming on, but I think the biggest story for the construction industry of the past week or two was the Competition and Markets Authority handing down fines totalling £60 million to 10 demolition contractors. Did you read about this?
I did indeed, yes. And I read your article about it. I mean, we cartel activity in the construction industry isn't completely unknown.
To say the least.
To say the least. And in fact, I'm not even sure that I haven't encountered a demolition cartel previously. I don't know whether I have or not. I know things like aggregates and concrete and stuff like that have, you know, regularly crop up. But yes, demolition contractors colluding, bid rigging, basically, wasn't it?
And cover pricing. They say,
that's
I'll bid for this job and you bid for that job, and we'll all see each other right. So
yes,
they can all bid higher than they otherwise would.
Yes, and it's rather depressing to see some extremely well-known names in the list of people who have been accused of this. I mean, a lot of the biggest demolition contractors in the country, in fact. Yeah, they've been handed down some pretty big fines. I mean, over 2 million, 2.5 million.
Erith, 17.5 million. McGee, 16 million.
Yeah.
They're the two biggest. But not because they were necessarily the worst offenders, but because they've got the biggest turnover. But it's Kelt Bay appealing against the size of their fines. They make the point that, well, actually, our demolition firm, which we've since folded and we don't do that anymore, is much smaller. It's only a tiny part of our whole. And you've based our fine on the entire group turnover, which we think is unfair.
Hmm.
I'm not sure I go along with that, because it's meant to be a punishment. And if Kelt Bay is only given a much smaller fine that it can easily afford, it's kind of like, oh, well, almost worth it then, isn't it?
Well, exactly. I mean, presumably it's still the same company with the same people, although they did make a comment about, you know, a lot has changed since all this happened. But I think the investigation only started in 2019. It's not that long ago. And certainly things might have changed in the meantime. But I mean, I hadn't realised that Celt Braille are no longer involved in demolition. I always thought that they were. And I will be including them in my roundup of the demolition top 20 in the next issue of the magazine. I'm not going to change it now. So, yeah, I think it's a bit, I don't know, I'm not convinced by their argument anyway. I think once you've been, you know, fingered by the authorities for, you know, doing something wrong, the best thing to do is to put your hand up and say, yeah, fair cop, Gov, and just try and get it over and done with as quickly as possible.
Yeah, they've all clearly been found bang to rights. I mean, the investigation was pretty thorough, and they've listed all the 19 contracts that were corrupted by cover pricing and cartel activity.
Yeah.
Some pretty big jobs.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I can't remember the last time there was a big cartel story in the UK construction industry.
There's one with concrete precast concrete drainage products.
Oh, right, okay.
Not very many years ago.
Yes, that's true, yeah. Now, that was quite interesting because I was looking into that sector of the industry at around that time, and there are one or two companies that entered the UK, well, one company in particular, I can think a Dutch company, that entered the UK precast concrete drainage industry at around that time and made quite a good fist of taking a share of the market, but they were squeezed out in the end and it wasn't worth them staying. They were here for a couple of years and then they packed up and went home again. So I guess that's what protectionism and cartels and all that kind of thing is all about, you know, keeping the market to yourself or sharing it out amongst your mates. So, yeah, rather depressing to see the demolition industry so deeply mired in this sort of activity and so many otherwise respectable names being trotted out as well. So, yeah, not a good piece of news, that one.
On the plus side, for balance, one of the bad guys, McGee, which actually has since changed, talked about lots of companies rapidly changed things around in the wake of this investigation, you know, when they got found out, basically. McGee was sold to its employees, I believe, soon after this all started. And we ran a story this week about a project that McGee has got in the City of London, which is quite interesting. We've talked about this before. I can't remember what the context was. Someone put out a paper saying it's feasible or we should look at reusing structural steel.
Yes.
Do you remember? Was it steel or was it precast concrete? Precast concrete components.
Yeah, actually, I think it was precast concrete. That's a good point.
But anyway, on this job, McGee are taking out the structural steel from a City of London office building and going to recertify it, refabricate it, and reuse it in the... It's not a new building, but it's a heavy revamp of this building. They're taking half of it apart and rebuilding the back of it and that kind of stuff. It's a pretty major revamp. The building is at One Golden Lane, City of London. It's not a very old building. It's only built in the
1980s, isn't it?
1980s.
Yeah.
Although I've just seen that I need to change that. I've got a typo. I've written it as the 1890s on my site.
No, but the original building on the site was built in the 1890s, and I was confused to begin with about that. There's part of the original building which is going to be preserved, and that was built in the 1890s.
I didn't make a mistake. Good.
No, I reread the press release when I saw that. And no, the original building, part of which still exists, was built in the 1890s, and that's going to be preserved. But the newer building, which was built in the 1980s, is going to be
revamped.
Yeah, revamped, not demolished, but deconstructed, and then the steelwork reused. And I have in fact asked McGee to for a bit more information about this. I don't know exactly what proportion of the steelwork is going to be repurposed, and I don't know what it involves. I mean, they talk about ribbon cutting, you know, taking out the beams and ribbon cutting them to refabricate them, and not being in the steelwork industry, I don't really know what they mean by ribbon cutting. So it's not easy to tell from what they've given away so far how much refabrication is going to involve. I mean, whether they're going to have to drill new holes maybe for bolts or weld bits on or cut bits off. But the idea, I suppose, is that, you know, you've got perfectly serviceable rolled steel sections, which have only been on site for 30 years or so, if that. And they're perfectly good. And so why not reuse them rather than take them away, melt them down, use all that expensive energy to smelt them into something else? Just drill new holes in them, bolt them together in a different way.
So it's meant to be, they say it's terribly pioneering and innovative move in recycling. Yeah. Everything. So what my takeaway from all of this is that the British demolition industry is not just corrupt, it's also very cunning and clever. I don't know if that makes me more optimistic or less optimistic, but I'm being facetious. We should wish McGee well for the good work that they're doing.
Condemn
the bad that they've all been doing.
Yes, absolutely. No, I mean, the demolition industry, as an industry, has come on leaps and bounds. I mean, their health and safety record has improved massively. We had Didcot Power Station, which was a bit of a blot on the landscape. Well, not a blot on the landscape, it was a blot on the industry's record. But that aside, general standards of health and safety in the demolition sector have improved enormously in the last couple of decades. They're pretty clever. They've done a lot about recycling and reuse, and they've got a lot to be proud of. So, putting that against the cartel activity, and you weigh them in a balance.
Should we move on to our main event of the episode?
Yes, indeed. Let's do that. The main event, of course, is that we have a guest joining us on the podcast today. We don't often have guests on Reconstruction, but occasionally somebody says or does something that we find particularly interesting, and we invite them on to tell us a little bit more about it. And that's the case with our guest this morning. And he is Conservative MP Saki Bhatti, whose Meriden constituency in the West Midlands is directly in the path of HS2. Now, Mr. Bhatti spoke recently in a House of Commons debate about HS2 and its local community relations, during which he noted, among other things, that the construction of a new HS2 interchange station and Arden Cross development will improve connections and create thousands of jobs. But it's fair to say that he's not 100% delighted with HS2 Limited's efforts towards community engagement, and he's here to tell us why. Well, welcome to Reconstruction, Mr. Bhatti. Nice to have you here.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me on.
Jolly good. We're going to focus on the concerns you have about HS2. There are obvious benefits, which you've acknowledged, but tell us what's been rattling your cage about this.
So, look, my constituency is one of the largest by geographical size in the West Midlands. It has a massive amount of green belt. And I think it's important just to acknowledge the fact that we also have Birmingham Airport. We have train connections to central London, which are between an hour and 20 and an hour and 30 minutes. And so for me, when HS2 have come into my constituency, the project, of course, started, I was elected in 2019, so the project started before I was elected. And, I've got no issue with investing in rail infrastructure. I've got no issue in high-speed rail. But I also have the interchange station being built in my constituency. And when you hear the stats of 36 minutes from the Midlands to London, that is precisely from my constituency. And what it will do, it will connect Birmingham Airport, it will connect the rail stations, and also the regional network, and effectively make my constituency one of the best connected in the country and in the world. But of course, with that comes an immense cost, which is fundamentally that the HS2, there's no better way of putting it, they are effectively ripping up my villages to lay the track, to do all the preparatory works. One of the things I knew when I was elected and selected as a candidate was how much of a hot potato HS2 was as a concept and as a project. And I knew the issues that it was creating for my constituents. But it's only when you're elected and you get your feet under the table do you fully realise the extent of the issue. And for me, the major thing is the community engagement, really, because every aspect of the line, and you know, it's become much more acute in recent months and years because the project has obviously progressed, not progressing as quickly as I'd like, to be honest, but it's progressing, and you get to see firsthand what the engagement's like. And I was lucky enough to get an adjournment debate in Parliament. It's a ballot that you have to put in for, and by pure coincidence, it was in the same week that there was an announcement as to the project having delays put in and all that. So the spot I was really on HS2, and it gave me a great opportunity to talk about some of the issues that are concerning my constituents. And there were individual cases that I raised where HS2's contractors are, you know, operating around my constituents and causing anxiety. There were broader issues around haulage routes, which is going through my village of Borstal Common, mm-hmm. which was one of the first major issues I had to deal with. And as we dig into it, I'll explain a bit more as to what their community engagement looked like in Borstal Common. But it really highlighted the kind of, we will listen to you, but this is our position, mm-hmm. and we'll carry on and we'll keep saying the same thing until effectively grinding down my constituents. I'm very proud of my constituents because actually they weren't ground down. They launched a massive petition. Yeah. They've really fought back. And then finally, because of the vast lengths that this project is going to cover, there are viaducts being built in my constituency. And I think what really triggered me on this issue was, under the banner of engagement, what we really had was, this is what's happening and we've listened to your suggestions and all the things you've suggested and thought of solutions you've provided, but actually they can't work for the following reasons. And I think when I sat down to write my speech, I thought, what's my ask around the viaducts? The constituent stuff is easier in that sense because you know the solution you need to get to.
Yeah.
But I just reflected on the fact that we're building one of the biggest infrastructure projects that this country's seen, certainly in this century and possibly ever. And it's having a great drain on our resources. If you talk to constructors and contractors, there's drain on steel is hard to get, concrete, other materials. But there's no conversation about what it's going to look like. What's the legacy it's going to leave?
I mean, it's a bit of a sorry to interrupt, but it's a bit of a curious egg, isn't it, for you, that because you've got the benefits of the connections and the rapid transport into London, so you know a proportion of your constituents are going to be welcoming of the scheme, and it might even introduce bring more people into the area to invest in businesses, to settle there, to live there. It's really that you've got two opposing camps almost. You've got the sort of the urban constituents, and you've got the rural constituents, the ones whose villages are going to have HS2 go straight through them or right past them. Isn't that always a problem with a big infrastructure job, though? You're always going to get that, on the one hand and on the other hand.
So, look, it's an important point you raise, because on big projects, that is certainly the case. And as I said, because we are the largest amount of greenbelt in the West Midlands, we are certainly facing a lot of projects and a lot of demand for construction in the patch. And that is, look, something I have to make judgments on, and as the elected member of parliament, what is good for the community. But this goes beyond that, I think, because you will see, while there's a great acknowledgement that there are benefits and housing and jobs and around the interchange station, I've got probably some of the most valuable land in the country now because of the opportunities that it's going to create. That doesn't excuse HS2 from their levels of engagement. It also doesn't excuse them from the standard of what I would call the aesthetics that they ought to be thinking about and they should be delivering. And for me, that is a great failure on behalf of HS2 Limited, because what will happen is they will build these big viaducts, they will leave, they'll make promises around, you know, I talked about graffiti and all sorts of things in the debate, but you know, after they've gone, I know I will spend a lot of time, a lot of resource, and trying to get them back to, you know, make sure they deal with the issues that are left behind. And I think that's going to be a great challenge, and I can say that with much certainty because I've already had to deal with them in the run-up to constructing these things. So once they've, you know, out of my hair, so to speak, they really won't, you know, they'll just be impossible to get back. So I think there's real legitimate concern about that. But there's a broader point here as well about the legacy aspect. And I mentioned Sir Christopher Wren, and I mentioned Brunel and Augustus Pugin. And the point I was simply illustrating was, you know, why don't we build things beautifully anymore? Why don't we focus on creating pieces of architecture that we can all be proud of? And I actually think a lot of the community would probably get would increase their support for the project. They've already said so. Most of the people are quite reasonable about it.
Yeah,
no one's going to say they want ugly things. And everyone wants everything to be beautiful, including our own bodies. But the problem is with HS2 is the cost. I mean, the money, it's already gone over 100 billion, depending on what they end up building. And you make the point that Bothwell Common Viaduct isn't as elegant a solution as the Cone Valley Viaduct. And I think there's some validity to that, but they're both essentially long concrete boxes on stilts. And I would imagine to make Bothwell Common Viaduct as beautiful as a Pugin building would involve a lot more cost, and then you'd have maybe not your constituents, but the you know, voters as a whole going, oh, it's more waste on HS2. How do you square that circle?
Well, look, my argument would be actually at this stage, because as you've correctly said, it's a concrete box or a concrete tube. I think there are things they could do to make it prettier, if I can use that term, or more aesthetically pleasing. And actually, to be honest, the fundamental issue here is they didn't plan for this, right? They just accepted that they were going to do this. They saw it as an engineering project rather than also a legacy project that they needed to deliver. And I think that fundamentally it's the groupthink that I particularly have an issue with. But look, we've built bridges before in this country that are beautiful. We've built, they are building the viaduct in Birmingham, which they've called the Bellingham Viaduct, which is named after Jude Bellingham. Now, I'm assured, I met with HS2 just last week, I'm assured that it's you know, different engineering parameters and things. But I am still of the view that there are things that could be done to make it fit. And I think what particularly triggered me, and I talk about it in my speech, is to link it to the local community. They found what I would argue are obscure references to a flax plant that grows. And they basically designed these squiggles into the concrete and thought that would appease my constituents, right? That would answer the questions around how they're going to deal with the graffiti aspect of it, because it's clearly going to be a draw for antisocial behaviour and graffiti. How do we manage that in an effective way? How do you deal with the eyesore elements of it, which I'll be the first one to argue we need to manage that. And so to answer your cost question, I think the fundamental issue is they just didn't plan for this. And we saw this in the haulage route, which was basically a route to transport materials through the village to be fair to them, they came to me to say, look, they wanted to minimize the disruption to the village, except the villagers since 2016 had been giving alternative solutions, which they'd basically been winding down the clock. And I remember in March 2020, I think it was, or April, we had this meeting with the community, and they just basically repeated the same PowerPoint presentation to me. The standard tactic, unfortunately, is they'll take the views, they'll go say, we'll go away and we'll incorporate these, or we'll take them into consideration. And then they just come back and they give the same presentation without any acknowledgement that those conversations were had. So I have to note down everything. My team are always on top of what's being said, because we need an audit trail, and we need to be able to say this is what it is. And that all that did was actually just increase the frustration for my constituents, until there was a massive petition put together, about 2,500 people. And frankly, fundamentally, I think my frustration comes from the fact that most of that could have been avoided.
I mean, I do take your point about the repeated PowerPoint presentations. That must really rankle when, you know, you've sat down, you've digested a PowerPoint presentation or a speech from somebody, given your opinions, they go away and say they're going to think about it, and then come back and feed you the same crap again. Is it a question that, you know, HS2 is a massive undertaking worth, you know, billions and billions of pounds, and there are a couple of small villages in your constituency that are upset about it, but at the end of the day, it's just a few hundred people and they don't count. Is that the way you see it?
No, not at all. And I mean, as I said, in Borstal Common, we've got it was 2.5. The petition was 2,500 people.
Right.
Obviously, the villages are much larger than that. But what I'll say is the actual. There's two fundamental issues here. Firstly, it's a project that's going to go across most of England, or mm-hmm. a significant part of England, and actually
not the right bits. It's not going to Leeds.
there are bits where there's lots of other MPs who are going to be affected. Mm-hmm. I've spoken to a lot of HS2 ministers who, and I say ministers because there's been quite a little bit of churn in the last 12 months. But and the point I made to them repeatedly is the issues you're facing in my constituency. They are, you know, unless you get HS2 Limited under control, so to speak, or hold them to account, they will continue to do this, and this will irk MPs all the way down. So it's going to affect tens and tens of thousands of people, if I'm honest with you. But there's a broader point here, which is when I stood up in Parliament and spoke about this, it's about having pride in your projects and having pride in your environment. And I don't think it's an unreasonable ask to say, hey, hang on a minute, what's the legacy here? How are we going to make this more beautiful? And, you know, I compared it to Spaghetti Junction. You know, I used Spaghetti Junction most of my life as I was growing up. And, you know, from a utility perspective, it's incredibly effective. But from a, you know, you'd struggle to find people who'd say it's aesthetically the most pleasing thing we've got. And actually, we should be thinking about stuff. So, you know, in 100 years' time, what are the things that we're leaving behind for our communities? And so I really felt passionately about standing up and saying, actually, let's just take a pause here and have a think about what we're building.
You mentioned that obviously it's a linear project; it goes all the way from London to Birmingham, or at least it will. Have you? I assume that you must have spoken to other MPs with constituencies that have HS2 going through them. And I imagine that given the route of the of HS2, they're probably mostly Tory MPs like yourself, aren't they? I mean, is there a group of MPs in Parliament that are sort of preparing to, I don't know, form a pressure group against HS2 or to try and influence HS2?
You must have a WhatsApp group. Everyone has a WhatsApp group.
I think there's no formal group from my understanding, or at least if there is, I'm not in it. And you know, which is
slightly
worrying. Slightly worrying. So, I was involved in the business community in the West Midlands for a long time before I was elected. I remember the business case being put forward I was a local enterprise partnership director for this area. So I remember the business case being put forward. And one thing I've always been very clear about, you know, and it goes to the heart of your earlier question, because this isn't about NIMBYism, right? This isn't about not in my backyard. What it actually is about is doing things the right way, or at least doing things that take people with you, and I think, which is where I think HS2 have failed. And I think for me, fundamentally, clearly our rail infrastructure needs investment. We know that. I think the government has put money behind this. They're very keen to upgrade our infrastructure. When we're talking about competing with the rest of the world, whether it's Japan or China or South Korea or even Morocco these days, you know, high speed rail is a key aspect of that. But I think my debate was really about how you deliver those projects, how you take communities with you, and how you get infrastructure through. And of course, community engagement is only one aspect of that. But there's certainly, when I had the debate, I think Bill Cash was there, who is the MP for Stone. Yeah. He spoke after me, which is quite rare in a German debate. You have to get permission to do that. He did that. We also had the head of the Transport Select Committee there, Ian Stewart, who is the MP for Milton Keynes, I believe. And I'm going to invite the Transport Select Committee to come and visit the constituency so they can see this first and foremost, because I think most people who aren't familiar with, especially my aspect of the project, will certainly think, oh, is this just because they don't want it in their backyard, they don't want their villages? Look, there are going to be people who are never going to be pro the project, but actually this is about how HS2 engages with those communities and effectively takes them with them. And I think that their lives would be a lot easier if they just listen to people and try to do a much more consultative approach rather than a we will talk and you will listen.
It's a question of hearts and minds, isn't it?
We've been talking so far about specifically about HS2. HS2 is, in this context, two things. It's a project and it's HS2 Limited, an organisation, the client organisation. And I can imagine that most of your conversations are with HS2 Limited. But do you talk directly to the people who are doing the building work, who are doing the design work? I mean, the Bothell Common Viaduct, which you are so critical of, I've just looked up who designed it. Mott MacDonald and Sister, the engineers, and Weston Williamson and Partners, the architects. Have you spoken to these people, or are you going only to HS2 Limited?
No, I have. I have. And so HS2, normally when they come to see me, they also, the main subcontractor, BBV, they normally have representation and representatives from there who will normally discuss issues. In fact, I just after the debate, they came to see me last week to kind of dig into the detail of what I thought. But when I went to, I mentioned in my speech, the HS2 did an engagement event, a community engagement event, which was a You Said We Did event. And I kind of slightly cheekily called it the You Said We Did Not event. And the reason I did, there was one slide there which basically said, you said this, and these were all the reasons. I took a picture of that because I thought this is clearly something, this is really epitomised the point I was trying to make. But the architect was there who designed the viaduct, and we had a conversation, and we talked about the flags, and we talked about the graffiti, etc. Mm-hmm. And I'm very careful when I have those meetings not to give opinions straight away. It's very, I could get very emotional, but I just remember walking out of the event and basically digesting what I'd been told and thinking about it. And there was a constituent who walked out with me, and we'd never met before. The first time I met the constituent, and she said to me, what do you think? And I said, I just can't get away from this idea that they've just created this concrete block in the middle of our countryside. And I'm not convinced about is that they couldn't have done a better job. And I think that's fundamentally what, next day I was in the office saying, right, we're going to put in for an adjournment debate, because I just don't think they've gone far enough, really. And, I was very clear with the minister as well that this is, I will keep coming back on this issue, because rather than just HS2, I suspect I may come back on this for many, many, as long as the people of Meriden keep returning me, it might be one of those things that I keep coming back about, because we should be building beautiful. We should be thinking about what our communities look like and what's the legacy we're leaving, because projects like this are going to last for decades.
Did you get the impression that the architect was proud of their work, or were they slightly sheepish that they'd been?
They were proud from what I could tell. If I walk in their shoes, maybe that's because they've spent so much time putting this together and it's an engineering feat. And I'm sure, I'm a layperson when it comes to engineering. I'm sure there's lots of really interesting things about the sound barriers and how they're managing, the sound that will be of pollution and all those kind of things. But they were proud of that. And I think as I keep referring to the flax plant, I think that's the bit that really got me, which was actually last week I spoke to them and we talked about having a green wall instead, so there's practical ways to do that. So they've told me they're going to go take that away and they're going to look at it, so let's see what they come back with.
There are a couple of lanes you mentioned in your speech, Waste Lane and Kelsey Lane, and as you pointed out, Waste Lane is a rather unfortunate name because it makes it sound a bit scuzzy, but it's actually a very pretty lane. But you made the point that the local villagers who use these lanes, I mean, they live on the lanes and kids walk along the lanes to get to school and stuff like that. They were the favoured routes for the contractors to carry out their lorry movements. So clearly you're going to have a huge increase in heavy traffic going along those lanes. I would say that your concerns were, I think most people would agree, fully justified, that if these are residential, narrow residential lanes and with pedestrians on them, you want to find an alternative. Has there been any movement on that, or is it still?
I'm told. So look, the fundamental delay there is the main haulage route that they had the planning application. The planning application was successful for. Mm-hmm. They got that. So this was related to the what I referred to earlier, where we kept getting these PowerPoint presentations about, they got that bit of it through, but they basically had not done the preparatory works. They hadn't really It looks like they just hadn't, they'd had to buy land outside of what was they thought, and they hadn't done any of the real negotiation about it. And I'm told now, as of last week, that they've really, that aspect of it is moving forward. But they were, the solution to, while it wasn't moving forward, was to get this planning application through on Waste Lane, which is, as you said, it's a tiny village lane. You've got lots of pedestrians, you've got kids using it for school, massive amount of disruption, and they want to do 400 lorry movements each day. And these aren't small lorries, right? These are big things, and lots of disruption. And again, what the constituents had said, and what my residents had said, was basically, well, since 2016, they'd been suggesting an alternative route which went over HS2 land, which would have required a temporary bridge being built over a network rail bridge. So, you know, there was some complex engineering required. But the fact of the matter is, had HS2 not put their foot down, they probably would have got it done, but you know, they would have moved on significantly. And fundamentally, what happens? You get delays. The cost goes up, and it creates a lot more anxiety. And so that's been a massive issue. And I believe it's with the Secretary of State at the moment. So we're at the mercy of that at the moment, that process.
I'm finding this particularly interesting that you've compared the Balthall Common Viaduct against the Cone Valley one, which is appears to have slightly more design thought into it, or it's slightly sleeker.
Yeah,
And you're talking about the Hall Roads. I'm pretty sure that the same contracting joint venture, a line that's doing the Cone Valley Viaduct, they've also built a fairly substantial temporary Hall Road.
They have.
For that. So it seems to be that one bit of HS2 is doing it, or appears to be doing it. I'm sure if I talk to people in their area, they go, no, they're getting it wrong too. But from the perspective of this discussion, it seems to be that a line seemed to be getting it right, and BBV, Balfour Beatty Vinci, seemed to be, whether they're cutting corners or they've bid too low for the work or for whatever reason, aren't going the extra mile that you would like them to.
Well, look, there are haulage routes set up temporarily. There are, you know, I mean, look, let's step back a little bit. The HS2 is having to get its material across, to get its big kind of excavators and lorries and whatnot to do. They're setting up temporary routes all over the patch. They're setting up temporary roads, this is a big engineering project. So
that is happening in your area.
Yeah, so what they're doing is there's definitely a road been set up to help that, and I believe that's a temporary road done later on down the line. That is, I'm talking about. But on this one here, the temporary haulage route, which is significant, they basically rejected ideas around conveyor belts, which I know have been used in Old Oak Common. They've rejected ideas around temporary haulage routes and the bridges and all those type of thing. And actually, by the way, I don't think it's about cutting corners. I actually just think they decided back in 2016 that this is what they were going to do, and they've stuck to their guns on this. And actually, rather than being bullheaded about it, if they just worked with the communities and said, actually, there is an idea here, we can build bridges, we can build routes that can minimise disruption. As I said, they would have been, I mean, this would, you know, I would not have been standing in Parliament talking about it two and a half years, three years later, when I was told that it would have been done within 12 to 18 months. And they haven't even, the point is, they haven't even started on the haulage route yet. I think next month is when they think it's going to be open. And that the insistence now is that they're still going to have to use Waste Lane, and it's going to have to be for a few years. And so my constituents have got the worst of all worlds, mainly because HS2 have been arrogant about it, from what I can tell.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if there's any movement following. I mean, I'm sure, I don't know how influential reconstruction is with this, but you've clearly aired your opinions very forcefully, both here and obviously in Parliament. And it seems from looking at your, you know, reading your speech in Hansard and seeing what Bill Cash has to say as well, you're not alone in this. There are other people who have similar concerns, and I'd like to think that somebody at HS2 Limited is listening and that they might make some changes as a result. I suppose it's always going to be a problem, though, with a big infrastructure project like this, that you're going to upset somebody. You can't please everybody. And I think probably what you're saying is that it's how you handle it, and it's how, you know, winning hearts and minds is crucial on a project like this, isn't it?
And I'd probably add the point about lines of communication within the organisation probably matter, because if I'm speaking to someone, you know, I'd like to think that is being communicated to the top. Mm-hmm. But I suspect what happens is there's so many layers of bureaucracy that by the time it gets to, it's probably a game of Chinese whispers, by the time it gets to the someone who can make the decision, the decisions are moulded in a way that the you know, at every layer someone's thought, oh, well, no, that's not right, we can't do this. And so, I'm a chartered accountant, I've advised organisations and large organisations on how they're structured. I suspect that that plays a significant role in why the project's being delivered in the way it is, and that's a real shame, because as I said, you know, once it's up and running, we'll be living with this for decades, and I think people will think about it and go, well, why did we not build something more beautiful?
Phil, have you got anything to add?
No, I just want to say, I think, Saki, thank you very, very much indeed for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the invitation. Thank you. I was really pleased to get your invite, and I hope I can come back to talk about maybe something positive in the future when they've delivered on it.
Excellent.
That'd be good. Yes. Excellent. Okay, Saki, thanks ever so much. Great to have you on. Well, I thought that was a very interesting discussion, Phil, actually. I'm glad we had Saqib on. And we will continue to keep an eye on what's going on along HS2 and how people respond to it along the route. But let's move on to another topic now. We've talked on many occasions about fuel and carbon emissions and everything connected with that. And one of the names that crops up quite frequently is Balfour Beatty, which is, of course, our biggest contractor in the UK. And Balfour Beatty has a particular stance on carbon emissions and particularly fuels. If you remember, they were the first...
Or HOV, hydrotreated vegetable oil. They were the... I was going to say the opposition. I don't quite mean that, but they put their head above the parapet and took a different view, didn't they?
Well, that's right. I suppose if you're Balfour Beatty, you can put your head above the parapet and say, no, actually, I don't agree with that. But that's what they did with HVO, hydrotreated vegetable oil, which, of course, was the best thing since sliced bread, according to a lot of people in the plant industry, because, you know, it's made out of a waste product, it's not a fossil fuel, and it's all very green. And just to very quickly summarise, Balfour Beatty said, well, hang on a second, hydrotreated vegetable oil is supposedly made out of waste cooking oil, which of course is a finite resource, and if everybody starts using this stuff in their excavators and lorries and whatever, sooner or later we're going to run out of used cooking oil, and people are going to start using things like palm oil, and it's going to cause deforestation. So there was a bit of a caveat there, you know, HVO isn't necessarily as good.
There's more than a suggestion. There's already deforestation happening, although lots of it's all certified, and everyone can say, we can, you know, this certificate guarantees that our HVO is purely from Harry Ramsden's and it's not from Malaysian palm trees. It's all a bit muddier than that. There can be stuff mixed in down the line.
Absolutely.
But broadly speaking, the argument is, the consensus is, at the moment, stuff certified as good we can use, and Balfour Beatty's line is, well, we're not going to get into that trap, because as soon as you start going down that path, before too long we will be chopping down rainforests and so on.
Well, they've done it again. Joe Gilroy, who's Balfour Beatty's group sustainability director, I think that's her title, who I interviewed for an article in the magazine about the HVO business. She's come along, and she's well, it's not just Joe Gilroy, obviously, but she's the person who sort of leads the research at Balfour Beatty into these things. They did a very interesting trial of electric plant up in Scotland on I think it's the Royal
Botanic Gardens.
The Royal Botanic Gardens in Edinburgh. That's right, where they're doing quite a lot of work. And Balfour Beatty is working on that site. They decided they were going to use all electric plant, and I think it was only small plant. There was a mini excavator, a site dumper, a telehandler, a compaction plate. I think that was it.
That's about it. A 6-week trial.
Yeah, so they did a trial, and the conclusion was that Yeah, but it's okay for small plant, not for big plant.
Well, not even for the mini excavator and the telehandler, it wasn't.
No, that's true, because they could only work for, was it 4 hours at a go?
Yeah, you only got half a day's work out of it. The whacker plate and the dumper gave a full working day, but the telehandler and the excavator, yeah, 4 hours working at capacity. Which basically browbeated their conclusion from this, having already said that HVO, not for us, thanks. Battery-powered plant, not for us, thanks. Mm. Which is, once again, counter to industry orthodoxy. Which yes, is yes. why I think this Joe Gilroy is becoming one of the most interesting, fascinating people in the construction industry for saying what other people seem shy or shy of saying, don't want to say, won't acknowledge. And it's an interesting study.
Well, she's a very influential person, I guess, because of, you know, the organisation that she represents. You know, when Balfour Beatty takes a stance on something, people are going to notice. Her conclusion was that actually, rather than pursuing battery electric power for heavy plant particularly, she would much rather explore the possibility of hydrogen. And that's something which, of course, JCB famously is very interested in. They've done quite a lot of work in that area, and in fact Balfour Beatty and JCB and somebody else who's I can't remember offhand who it was are currently working together to try and develop
Sunbelt, their rental company, A Plant, as was,
yes, that's right, looking into the use of hydrogen. And of course hydrogen can be used in two different ways to generate power in vehicles. You can use it as a fuel cell, which I don't know quite how a hydrogen fuel cell works, but that generates electricity. So you've got an electric machine which uses hydrogen as its fuel. I think, and people will correct me if I'm wrong there, I think I'm on fairly safe ground. The other way, of course,
no,
is that correct? And the other way of using hydrogen is actually to burn it as you would any other fuel in an internal combustion engine.
Yeah, yeah. Which is, I think, what Anthony Bamford, Lord Bamford, is while they make electric plant, his bigger picture, I think he's quite keen on keeping the internal combustion engine alive with hydrogen as the fuel. That seems to be the vision, if not the where we're at yet.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there are clearly many hurdles to get over in order to make this a reality. It's very, very early days, and one of the problems is how do you produce green hydrogen? One of the problems with these green technologies is that if you look far enough back, you'll find that you come up against a problem. And one of the problems is that hydrogen takes a lot of electricity to actually generate, and so you've got. Now you've got something called blue hydrogen, which is hydrogen made from electricity, which isn't necessarily generated by renewable power sources like wind or solar. And then you've got green hydrogen, which is made using renewable electricity from wind or solar or biomass or something like that. And there simply isn't enough green hydrogen at the moment to make this viable. And there are questions about transporting hydrogen, all that kind of stuff. There are lots of different questions which need answering before we can actually say that hydrogen is the way forward. But clearly, Balfour Beatty seems to think that it is.
Joe Gilroy made all of that clear. She's got posted a blog on the Balfour Beatty website, and she set out the huge problems, the obstacles facing us before we can get hydrogen fuel for construction industry. Hmm. You've mentioned some of them, and there are others. Just the cost and the trouble, and oh, it's going to be so, so difficult.
Yeah.
And yet, so that you're reading that thinking, oh, this is all a bit glum. And then her conclusion is, so it's going to be 2025 at the earliest before it becomes viable. Well, we're in the middle of 2023 now. I mean, 2025.
Yes, 2025 is just around the corner.
For someone of my age, that's tomorrow. Yeah. I mean, it will be virtually tomorrow we're going to solve all of these problems.
Yeah.
So it's a very upbeat assessment, I think, on the timescale.
I think it'll take a bit longer than that.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah, we will see. And I'd be surprised if you can declare it fully viable in 18 months' time. Seems unlikely to me. But clearly, that's one route. And we have been hearing a lot more about hydrogen over the last year or so. It seems to have become a little bit more prominent as a possibility, whereas of course electric plant has been something which is far more well established.
Yeah, but I'm just looking forward to seeing what orthodoxy Balfour-Beatty, Joe Gilroy shatter next. But I'll be looking out for it with interest. I think we've had quite a busy morning. Anything else on your side, David?
Nothing so urgent that I need to discuss it now. We can wait for another fortnight, I guess.
I would give a quick shout out to Matt Palmer, who is joined the Construction Leadership Council as the industry sponsor for net zero and biodiversity. So he is Mr. Okay. Green at the Construction Leadership Council. Very important job.
Yeah.
I can't help thinking there's a certain irony that his day job is being in charge of the Lower Thames Crossing, which, according to Essex Wildlife Trust, is going to destroy habitats of importance for protected water voles, reptiles and rare invertebrates.
Hmm.
And it'll have, it's been labelled one of the most environmentally damaging projects in the country. But to be fair to National Highways, they are going to plant 1 million trees and use electric diggers.
Oh, well, so there we are.
It might be okay.
Yeah, absolutely fine.
Right, we're done then.
I think we are.
Have you got any Easter eggs purchased yet, David?
You know, Easter, I don't know if it's because they keep moving it, but it always creeps up on me. I'm never prepared for Easter. And all of a sudden I find out I've got 2 bank holidays and I haven't planned to do anything. So basically, no, I'll just be twiddling my thumbs or I'll be in the garden.
Yeah.
Or I'll be climbing up a hill. I'll be climbing up a hill for a crucifixion on Friday morning, of course. Because we have a large hill overlooking our village here in Devon, and every Good Friday, a very large cross is carried up by the villagers to the top of the hill,
Wicker Man style,
and a crucifixion takes place. Yeah, absolutely. We don't actually nail anybody up to the onto the cross, not these days anyway. But it's an excuse to get up early in the morning and go for a walk.
Very good. I'm afraid the only temples I go to are the temples of Mammon, and I visited the Battersea Power Station development last Saturday.
Oh, really?
Okay. For the first time. I know it's been open a while, but the old turbine hall and the part of it when you mm-hmm. walk in is a big
it's a shopping centre now, isn't it?
Mall.
Yeah.
Rather above my tastes and budget. I have to say, what they've done in that building is fabulous. I was very struck by they've still got the huge great overhead travelling cranes in there.
Oh, wonderful!
If you look up, and it's beautifully done.
Ah, well worth a visit. I will have to pay a visit next time I'm up there. I'll pay a visit and see what I think of it.
Right, but I've just got to say goodbye to everyone. Thank you very much for listening. As usual, feedback to podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. We're also very interested to read any reviews that you might want to leave us if you subscribe to the podcast at a place where reviews can be left, or give us some stars, however many stars you think they're worth. Hint, 5. otherwise, for another week, that's me, Phil Bishop, and him, David Taylor, saying thank you and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.